So the first thing we'll talk about is, as we talked last time with the sanctity of marriage, and we talked about how what makes marriage, that when a couple comes together and they give their consent, there's a very old phrase from the canon law, and I brought the canon law, this is the entire code of canon law right here, an old phrase that just says consent makes marriage, and we talked about that last time when we talked about the sanctity of marriage. So what that means is the couple themselves making the consent, the couple saying I do, that's what creates the bond. It's when they do that, the Holy Spirit comes upon them and creates that bond. And that's why I want to say this just from the beginning, that the church assumes, the church always gives the benefit of the doubt, the church assumes that all marriages are valid until proven otherwise. So kind of like on Cops, when you hear, like, you know, they give that little thing in the beginning, you know, everyone is innocent until proven guilty. It's along those lines that the church assumes that all weddings are valid until they are proven otherwise. And that's just an important thing to remember, because that will answer a lot of your other questions, perhaps, as they come up, especially when you wonder, well, wait a minute, why does the church investigate weddings that were done by two Protestants in a Protestant church, or two Jews in a synagogue, or two atheists at the courthouse. They say, well, that has nothing to do with Catholicism. Why does the Catholic Church want to investigate that? Why do those need to be annulled? And that's the answer, is because the church assumes validity. The church assumes that when two people get up and say, I do, that they know what they're doing. I mean, and that it would seem to be an insult to people if we didn't assume that. If we did not assume that, if we just said, well, you don't know what you're talking about. So the church assumes that when people do that, that it is valid, right? So that's the first point. It is only until a couple comes to the church and says, we believe this to be invalid, or one of the two parties comes and says, we believe this to be invalid, and this is why, and they kind of present the evidence. And that's what it is a lot of times with this whole talk of annulments, you hear a lot of the same kind of legal mumbo-jumbo that you would hear when you think of like a courtroom or something. And we have in our church, we have ecclesiastical tribunals. We do have church courtrooms. We have judges, we have lawyers, we have evidence, we have witnesses. It's not so much in a giant courtroom when this all happens. A lot of this happens, everyone kind of doing their own thing, and it all comes before a judge behind a desk who just kind of puts all the things together. But you'll hear a lot of this kind of legal jargon, and that's what it is. It's evidence. So basically this is what happens, is when a couple comes to the church and says, you know, I want an annulment, I always try to tell a couple first, like, well, number one, whether or not your prior marriage is valid or invalid is already determined. Like, it already is valid or it already is not valid. The church cannot change that. The point of an annulment, the point of having that trial, that investigation, is to determine whether or not it is valid or invalid. So it's not like the church can change whether or not it is valid or invalid. The point of the annulment is to look into the evidence that's presented and to be able to say, based on the evidence that the couple themselves have brought forward and the other people that the church has talked to, witnesses, friends, whomever, based on the evidence that they bring forward, the church says this appears to have been invalid from the beginning. That's what an annulment is. And that's why the real word, the real phrase that's used is a declaration of nullity. People will sometimes correct you and say annulment. It's a declaration of nullity because the church is saying, based on all the evidence that we have been able to find, it appears as though we have moral certainty. We have moral certainty that this was invalid. So that's what's going on there. And I tell that to couples when they come to me or when they say, you know, I want to get an annulment. Well, I just say, well, I hope you understand that this isn't like a Catholic divorce. And that's always the big thing. People think that this is Catholic divorce. That if a Catholic wants a divorce, they just have to get it annulled. And the other thing you hear is, oh, well, if you throw enough money at the church, they'll grant the annulment. And I'm going to get to the money point in a second. But just to remember that from the beginning, that Because we assume all weddings are valid, because we assume that people know what they're doing when they get up before someone and say, I do, be them Catholic or otherwise, we assume that people know what they're doing, we give them the benefit of the doubt, and it would kind of be rude and snooty of us to say, well, you didn't really know what you were doing, and so we're not going to. No, that's why. That's why the church will investigate any wedding, any marriage that is brought before us. And this happens a lot, too, just by the way, because often if we have someone coming to us who wants to get married in the church and they have their fiancé is Protestant or Jewish or atheist or Muslim or whatever, and they were previously married, and we say, well, we need to get that marriage annulled, meaning we need to look at that marriage first to see if you are free to marry. Because this is of course, one of the conditions of marriage. You have to be free to marry. We're going to talk more about this in a little bit, too. But you're not free to marry if you are already married. That's what it comes down to, is you can only be married to one person at a time. If you are already married to someone, then you are not free to get remarried. And a civil divorce doesn't do anything in the eyes of God or the church. So someone says, well, I'm divorced. Well, that's fine. You know, that doesn't affect your standing with God. Or the best is they say, well, I made my peace with God. Well, you didn't make your peace with the church, and God speaks through the church, so either God's lying or you're lying, you know. God said he's going to speak through the church. So that answers that question, because people will wonder that sometimes, why does the church investigate other weddings? So basically, there are three things that can potentially invalidate a wedding, and we're going to discuss those three things briefly, and then I'm going to get into a few other quick things. Oh, the other thing I want to bring up, just before I forget, about the money, is it does cost money for this whole procedure to happen. It does cost money for the church to investigate a wedding. And let me tell you why. Because when a couple comes to the church and says they want to get an annulment, we have, like I said, all sorts of canon lawyers who work downtown, and they have to draw up all this paperwork, and they then have to spend time their own office time. I mean, this is what they're supposed to be doing, but they then have to spend all sorts of time and effort to then contact all of their family members and friends and really look into these things. And so the fact of the matter is, yes, it does take man hours to really investigate a wedding and to see, is this valid or is this not valid? And again, that's kind of the point, is that whether or not it's already valid is not for the church to determine. It's for the church to discover. Again, based on the evidence, yes, it is valid, and therefore we can't grant a declaration of nullity because it appears as though you are still married. And so if someone's trying to get remarried, we'll say, sorry, you can't get remarried because you are still married. So those three things, just to get to those three things. And by the way, just about the money, too. So yes, it does cost some money. The diocese, just so you know, whenever an annulment goes before the diocese actually just out of its own money pays for about half the cost. And then usually slaps the parish with some of it, and then usually after that, we'll then actually ask the people themselves for some sort of stipend. And sometimes people get like real offended or upset, like, you know, oh well, is this, you know, am I getting charged to have my marriage declared null, or if I don't have money, then this is not fair. And that's the other thing to consider, is that an annulment is never going to be ignored because the person can't pay. If a person can't pay, the church still does it. The church is, you know, this is part of our job, is to be able to look into this. So no one never is able to get an annulment because they don't have money to pay for it. So there's three things that can potentially make a marriage invalid: canonical form, impediment, and defect of consent, and I'm going to go into all three of those. So canonical form is this. Every single Catholic, and only Catholics, are bound to observe what is called canonical form, meaning to get married in a Catholic church by a Catholic minister, priest or deacon, right? So every Catholic is required to observe canonical form. And therefore, if a party to the wedding is Catholic, or if both parties are Catholic, but even if just one is Catholic, they're required to observe canonical form, which means they have to get married in the Catholic Church by a Catholic minister. Now, canonical form can be very easily dispensed for a good reason. So let me give you an example. Let's say you have a Catholic and a Protestant, and let's say the Protestant's dad is the local Protestant minister and always wanted to be able to do his daughter's wedding, you know. Well, then the church can say, well, that's fine. You know, we'll dispense you from canonical form. So maybe the groom is Catholic and the bride is Protestant, and like I said, her dad is maybe the local Lutheran pastor, and he wants to do the wedding, fine. And the church will dispense from canonical form, and so the wedding would be done in the Lutheran church by the Lutheran pastor, and it would be completely valid. The church would be dispensing from form, which means that the Catholic party is still in good standing with the church. It's a valid wedding as far as the church is concerned. Again, presumed valid. Other things could potentially make it invalid, but at least in terms of canonical form, the church would say, you know, we dispense canonical form, and so that Catholic is free to get married in that Lutheran church by that Lutheran pastor. Again, there would need to be a good reason. Another reason, for instance, is if one of the parties is not Christian at all or atheist, and there are times where maybe the family of that party would perhaps, or that party, him or herself, would feel uncomfortable in a Catholic Christian setting. So, for instance, this is another situation that's come up, is when you have like a Catholic and a Jew, and the Jew's family says, well, you know, we don't really feel comfortable in the church, and the crucifix and these kinds of things scare us, and we would rather not have it done in the church. And so they say, well, let's have it done like in a hotel or something. And we can dispense that. We can say, fine, that's a good reason. We don't want you to feel uncomfortable. We don't want you to be, you know, feeling uncomfortable this entire wedding. So we'll dispense from canonical form, and so you can have the wedding in a hotel room. And again, from a Catholic perspective, we would say that's fine, that's valid, because canonical form has been dispensed. And so even for like the Jewish rabbi to do it, or even for a justice of the peace to do it. So that's what canonical form is, and again, it's very easy to get dispensed from. But this is the other thing to keep in mind, is two Catholics will never be dispensed from canonical form. So if you have two Catholics that want to go get married in a hotel lobby just because, oh, well, this will make it easier for our guests to go to the reception because we're going to have the reception right there. Well, that's not going to happen. The church is going to say that's not a good enough reason. So you do still have to have the wedding in the Catholic church by a Catholic minister. You do still have to observe canonical form. So canonical form would not be dispensed in the situation of two Catholics. So, but again, it's very easy to get dispensed in any other circumstance. Just so long as there's some kind of reason that we can present to the bishop. And in fact, it doesn't even really go to the bishop. It's done in the bishop's name by someone at the chancery who's been delegated to do it. And again, it's very easy to get dispensed. But this is why, if two Catholics go off and go to Las Vegas and get married, that's not observing canonical form. So, like I said, canonical form is one of the three things that can make a wedding invalid. And again, it only binds Catholics. So when two Protestants get married, they're not bound to canonical form because they're Protestants. When two Jews get married, they're not bound to canonical form. So long as just one of the parties is Catholic, if at least one of the parties is Catholic, then canonical form has to either be observed or dispensed. Okay? So that's the first thing just to keep in mind. And that's very easy to determine. You don't have to really investigate much into that. You just have to prove that one of the two parties was Catholic and that canonical form was not observed, and then boom, it's invalid. And that happens all the time. If we have two Catholics who ran off to Vegas and got married, even if everything else was kosher and legit, we would say, well, you were bound to canonical form because you're Catholic and it was not dispensed, and therefore this is invalid. So that's the first. That's a very easy annulment to do. The next thing that can invalidate a marriage is an impediment. And I brought the Code of Canon Law with me here because it has a whole list of different impediments that can potentially make a marriage invalid. I'm not going to get into all of them, but just to give you an idea of what they are, for instance, if the bride and groom are not old enough to contract marriage, that is an impediment. So even if you have two 12-year-olds who say, we know what we're doing and we want to, well, the church will say, sorry, you're impeded from contracting marriage, you know, and even if, you know, everything else was done properly, sorry, it's invalid, you know. They go everywhere, they go everything from, to the ridiculous, really. If you abduct your spouse for the sake of getting married, that's an impediment. If you're related to them by blood to a certain degree, that's an impediment. So like, for instance, a brother and a sister cannot get married. They are impeded from getting married. And should they attempt to get married, it's invalid. Some impediments can be dispensed from, some cannot. You know what, I might just pull out the list here to make it easier. One impediment, for instance, is a prior bond, meaning you're already married. That's what I talked about before. You're already married, you can't get married. You know, that's an impediment to marriage. If you are already married, you cannot get married because you're already married. You can only be married to one person at a time. If you're a priest or nun, you can't get married. That's an impediment. If I were to decide to leave the priesthood and run off and go get married, and even if I were to go to a Catholic church and I were to hide my identity and I were to tell them I, you know, was just I mentioned nothing about the priesthood, I just presented myself as some regular old guy who wanted to get married, and let's say they never found out and they never looked at my baptismal certificate and found out I was a priest and whatever, and everything else was done properly, like that, I wouldn't be married. It would be invalid because I'm not capable of contracting marriage because I'm a priest, because I'm already under vows. So all of those different things can impede someone from marriage. And like I said, some impediments can be dispensed from, some impediments cannot. An example of something that can be dispensed from is, for instance, in certain cultures, it's actually, certain tribal cultures especially, it's common that you do marry within the family. Now, it's never brother-sister, of course, but sometimes it is like first cousins. And ordinarily, first cousins, most of these cultures, thank God, do really trace the bloodlines very well, so they make sure that it's not too close of a connection. But first cousins, but perhaps, I don't know how you can really be distant first cousins, but so in some cultures, for instance, that's done, where first cousins do marry. Now, ordinarily, first cousins are impeded from getting married, but that actually can be dispensed. If it's not dispensed, then the impediment remains and then the marriage is invalid. Give me one quick second just to look this up here. Okay. Priests or deacons, anyone in religious order, under perpetual vows of chastity or religious institute, if a man or woman was abducted and detained, then that can't be, that's an impediment, until, it's funny, canon law makes this clear, and you have to wonder why this is in canon law, because it's happened, until the abductee is free and able to choose on their own. If you murder someone to marry someone else, that's an impediment. So, it is, yeah. Canon 1090, Section 1, anyone with a view to entering a marriage with a certain person who has brought about the death of that person's spouse or one's own spouse invalidly attempts this marriage. So, if you murder your friend's spouse, if you murder your friend for the sake of marrying their spouse, that's an invalid wedding. I talked about the by blood. Okay, so that's enough of the impediments. Those usually don't apply too much. You very, very rarely run into someone who is impeded. By the way, just one other thing that is an impediment too, not being able to perform the marital act, that's actually an impediment. Now, that has to be clarified because that does not mean that someone is sterile. That means that they're not able to perform the marital act. So long as the marital act is able to be performed, whether or not the couple is sterile actually doesn't affect that. but you need to be able to perform the marital act in order for the wedding, in order for the marriage to be valid. So that can impede you. Now again, we're talking at the time of the wedding. So a couple who gets married and later on they're not able to perform the marital act, well, I assume that happens to everyone eventually. But at the time of the wedding, you need to be able to do that. And then lastly, the third thing, that, and this is what takes the most amount of time, and this is what invalidates most weddings, is the consent. Did you mean I do when you said I do? Were you ready, willing, and able to enter into the marriage? Did you really know what you were getting into? Now, that being said, no one ever knows exactly what they're getting into, and you're not expected to understand every single possible detail about marriage. You're not expected to know everything that might potentially come your way. But the point is, basically, when you said I do, did you mean I do? Did you mean yes to this? And there are two points that need to be made under this, is that sometimes you'll have a couple who is specifically withholding a certain type of consent. So like, for instance, an example of this is if you have a couple who at the time of their wedding has already determined, for instance, that they are not open to procreation, that we're just not going to have kids. Well, that's defective consent. If you're not able to, you're not giving your full consent if you're saying, I do, but I don't totally do. I do so long as we don't have kids. I do so long as whatever. Well, that's not really saying I do. So long as you put a condition on it, then it's not proper consent. Or, for instance, another example, I do so long as I feel attracted to you. Well, you know, and when I don't, then I can cheat on you and I can hook up with someone else. Well, that's defective consent. So sometimes you do have people that we find out afterwards who did, at the time of their wedding, have one of these conditions in their head. Now, they may not have ever articulated this, but if this condition was present, well, then that made the consent defective, if they didn't really mean I do when they said I do. So you have some people, and that's what we would call the sacrament being simulated, in the sense that they were intentionally kind of withholding their consent. Now, that's much different from someone who, for some other reason, their consent was defective. For instance, if they were, all sorts of different examples come to mind. Certainly, like if they were drunk at the time, you know, well, that obviously you're not really able to give consent if you're drunk. Sometimes it comes out that, you know, someone was really dealing with all sorts of psychological problems and would not have been able to have really consented to anything. I'm just trying to think of a few other examples that come to mind. If they didn't, anything that can affect the person from making an informed decision at the time. If any of those things get in the way, that can make consent defective. But the other thing to keep in mind too is that a lot of times this isn't someone's fault. Now, it is someone's fault if you are specifically saying, well, I do so long as you're attractive, or I do so long as you don't want any children, or I do. I mean, well, that's, you know, that is your fault. You knew that. You knew what you were doing there, and you shouldn't have been doing it. But that's much different from someone who says, I do, and it turns out that, you know, they really didn't know what they were getting into. They you know, again, because perhaps they were dealing with some kind of fantasy notion of marriage or what marriage would be like. So I guess one thing that I always like to point out too is that when a couple's marriage is getting annulled, when it's being investigated and it is annulled, it's not saying something bad necessarily about the couple. It's not like you did something wrong. It could just be you didn't really know what you were getting into. Now again, we have to qualify that, because no one really knows exactly what they're getting into, and we can't use that as an excuse to get an annulment. We can't say, well, I was just 17. Well, a 17-year-old, you know, can know what they're doing. according to canon law, so long as you're 16, you know, you should know what you're doing. Now, that doesn't mean every 16-year-old does know what they're doing. It doesn't mean every 30 or 40-year-old knows what they're doing. But the point is that, you know, it's not always reflective. It's not like someone sinned by not being able to make consent valid. So those three things, observing canonical form, impediments, and consent. Now, again, that first one, canonical form, again, only binds Catholics. So when we're doing an investigation into a marriage that involves two non-Catholics, Protestant and a Jew, two Protestants, two Jews, two atheists, whomever, we don't even look at canonical form because they were not bound to canonical form. And that's why, for instance, if two Protestants run off and get married in Vegas, it is presumed valid. If two Catholics run off and get married in Vegas, it is presumed invalid because they were held to canonical form and they were not dispensed from it, nor would they have been because they're two Catholics. But this is why, for instance, when, you know, if two Protestants run off to Vegas and get married, we say, well, we can't get them on canonical form because they weren't bound to canonical form. But if there was an impediment in the way, then that could have potentially made it invalid. Or more likely, what's often the case is the consent was defective. They were not giving sufficient consent. They were not ready, willing, and able to enter marriage as it's understood. So those are the three things. And what happens when a couple goes to get a marriage annulled is, like I said, this goes to all sorts of canon lawyers down in D.C. who deal with literally hundreds of cases each year of couples who are trying to get annulments. And the church does see it as a type of ministry of compassion, because if someone was in a marriage that was invalid, you know, the church wants that person to be able to be at peace and get remarried and to be able to kind of bring a certain closure to that previous marriage. And often that's what a couple is looking for when they go to get an annulment. And often, too, what they're looking for is to be able to get remarried. It's usually with an eye for remarriage. It's, I want to get married to this person, but I can't get married to this person until I get this wedding annulled, or this marriage annulled. And often, if that person was married before, then that marriage has to, and so you have to kind of trace all the way back to the first marriage. And then just one of the last things I was going to say, and I think that'll be it, and then I'll take questions, is the issue of communion, because people often wonder about that, receiving communion. It is not true that if you are simply divorced, you cannot receive communion. What the church teaches, again, the church doesn't see legal divorce as meaning anything. It doesn't do anything in the eyes of God. It doesn't do anything in the eyes of the church. You can get, I mean, don't get me wrong, you shouldn't go off and get legally divorced, but my point is, it doesn't affect one's status in the church. So if you have someone who is just divorced, well, they are still free to receive communion. The whole communion issue comes in when you have attempted marriage, and that's the word we use, attempted, because you didn't actually contract marriage, because you are still married, or at least you're presumed still married to this other person. But that's who cannot receive communion, is someone who is divorced and remarried without an annulment. And this happens all the time in the Catholic Church. You have people who were married and they got divorced, and then they got civilly remarried. And why did they get civilly remarried and not married in the church? Well, because they couldn't get married in the church because they didn't have an annulment from that first marriage, and so that first marriage was still considered valid, and so the church wouldn't marry them. And now they want to go and receive communion. Well, if you're living in an irregular situation such as that, well, that's why you can't receive communion. If you've entered into a new marriage with someone, you're essentially committing adultery, because you are presumed to still be married to that other person. Now, as a matter of fact, you may not actually be married to that person, but that can't be determined until we go through the annulment process. So it's entirely possible that your first marriage was invalid from day one, and that you are free to marry this other person. But we can't be sure of that until that marriage has been looked into, until that marriage has been investigated. Once it's been investigated, the church issues a decree of nullity, says, yes, that's null and void. You are free to remarry. And it's not remarry, it's marrying for the first time, I mean, because you're not already married. So that's why, because people wonder about that sometimes, too. I've had to clarify that with a lot of people who thought that they couldn't go to communion because they were simply divorced. No, if you are simply divorced, you can still receive communion. But you are not free to even date. You're not even free to so much as date until that prior marriage has been annulled, because again, we presume all marriage is valid, and if that marriage is valid, then you're not free to date, and you're certainly not free to get married because you're already married. It's very clear when you think about it logically that you can only get married to one person at a time. The other thing is about illegitimacy. Sometimes people wonder, like, well, if I get an annulment, does that make my children, you know, bastards? Does that make them illegitimate? No, it doesn't. Because, again, it's often the case that these weddings are entered into in good faith. And it's not like people are intentionally hiding things when they get married. Sometimes they might be. Sometimes both parties are. Sometimes just one party is and the other party is completely oblivious to it and is intending to enter a valid marriage. Or sometimes they say, well, does that mean that I was, you know, fornicating, you know, these whole 20 years that we were married, and now if we get it annulled, that means that I was committing adultery these 20 years because I was having relations with someone who wasn't actually my spouse? No, again, that doesn't mean that, because in your conscience, in your good faith, you were doing this with the person who you thought was your spouse. You know, now, as a matter of fact, they may not have been your spouse if you were not actually married, because one of the two of you had defective consent or an impediment, or whatever, but that always has to be cleared up. And then finally, of course, an annulment does not get rid of any kind of legal responsibilities, which is why if a couple is getting married and one of them has a previous marriage that was annulled, we still make sure that you are still providing for, you know, whatever legal responsibilities you have, especially to kids from that prior marriage, you know. And that's why if they're like a deadbeat dad who kind of ran off and they're not paying the child support, the church isn't going to let them get remarried. And then, finally, just the last thing I'll say is, often this is brought up about what happens if the other party doesn't cooperate. What happens if I'm trying to get an annulment and my ex-wife, ex-husband wants nothing to do with this? Does this mean that I just can't get an annulment? No. When you go to get an annulment, the tribunal at the diocese does always contact the other party and asks them whether or not, well, number one, lets them know that, you know, you've brought this forward for an annulment, and asks them whether or not they would like to participate. And they are free to choose not to do so. And some people want nothing to do with the other person, and they don't even respond to the letter from the chancellor, and that's fine. And the process can go on without them. Sometimes you'll have them respond, and they'll say, yes, I think this wedding is valid. I don't want it annulled. You know, I happen to think that this wedding is valid. If the other person wants to have their say in the tribunal, the church will absolutely hear them out. And this is why when this whole investigation is being done, this is the kind of people they talk to, and they talk to all of their friends, they talk to people who knew them. They really do an investigation. And again, that's why I brought up the point before about cost, is that it does cost money to do all of this. So I covered all the points I wanted to cover, and I'm sure there are lots of questions and lots of what about this, what about that, and I'm sure I've missed a lot too. So please feel free to ask whatever questions you have, and I'll try to answer them